I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Susan A. Massino. She's a neuroscientist and a professor of applied science at Trinity College. Her research is focused on promoting brain health and on the critical role of self-sustaining, climate-regulating ecosystems, particularly natural forests, to support local and global well-being. She's a co-author on a recent regional report titled Wildlands in New England, Past, Present, and Future, and on the seminal paper on proforestation, in other words, growing existing forests, as an essential and cost-effective strategy for long-term ecological and human health. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. It's wonderful to meet you and to have the opportunity to be on your program.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to have you. So my first question is, can you start by just diving into the relationship between wild spaces and, these are separate questions, wild spaces and brain health and wild spaces and mental health?
Interesting. So yeah, they are in a way separate questions, though, of course, I think mental health is brain health, but we'll take them separately. For this purpose. So, wild spaces have had such an important role throughout human history as places where people can find refuge and just get away in a place that's bigger than themselves and bigger than the human world, and have that kind of comfort and mystery and beauty and awe, and get to know a place and fall in love with a place, you know, almost like a friend. And so I'll just start with saying that I think having a piece of nature that you can fall in love with and connect to should be part of our natural heritage. Even if it's a small place in an urban area or a suburban area. And I think it can be one of the most powerful common solutions to our current crises of loneliness, anxiety, our ecological challenges, inability to think about and consider yourself as a scientist as you watch natural areas change and evolve. And of course, climate stability. We need natural systems for climate stability. In terms of more detailed information about brain health, there's just gobs and gobs of information about opportunities for better immune function, for more creativity and novel ideas, for reduced blood pressure, for reduced stress hormones, for, you know, just on and on, all the things that you would want to really augment for yourself and for other people that you spend time with at all ages and at all levels of abilities are really promoted by time in nature. There's really no evidence that it's harming us, which is one of the first sort of tenets of medical ethics, you know, first do no harm. And it has so many benefits that are proven, but we need to talk about, your first aspect of your question was wild spaces. And so I think we need to talk about what's the quality of these places that we're providing for people. And the term green spaces is often used, but what does that really mean? That could just be some lawn and a bench, or, you know, who knows what might be planted there? Is it native plants? Is it, you know, sort of a manicured garden? And there's definitely research coming out that people consider these older ecosystems and older forests more beautiful. And we know that these natural areas are far, you know, not even comparable in terms of ecology and other types of benefits. So we need to really talk about access, the integrity of these places, the quality, et cetera. We need to get much more specific about what we're doing, where and why, as kind of a big picture question.
I'm just thinking about how when I'm going to talk about myself going to a city and then talk about people I know at least going to a wild place. And when I go to a city, like when I'm on tour, I at the end of the day, I end up feeling abraded, like my skin's just been rubbed off. And there's been so many car horns and radios and so many sharp corners. And when I get done, I go back to my hotel room and just shut the drapes and leave the light off. I know it's a bit extreme, but and then I live in the Redwoods, and so many people, when they've come to visit, they'll see these huge ancient trees, and they can't help but have, I don't think it's too much to say, a religious experience. They have just this, almost everybody, as soon as they see them, they fall silent. And then I'm done. So take any of those wherever you want.
Yeah, well, your feeling of being abraded by, you know, sort of the hustle bustle of, you know, what for many of us is everyday life is something at least that you're sensitive to. And it's interesting that I work in Hartford, and that's the birthplace, and he's now buried in Hartford, Frederick Law Olmsted. And he really perceived back in the 1800s that the, you know, modern life, urbanicity was wearing down our battery. And he perceived nature as a way to sort of relax and yet recharge, basically. And he felt like everybody at the end of the day should be able to kind of put the cares of the day behind them and spend an hour just walking in a natural area. And he designed his natural areas that he designed. Some were not designed. They were just natural areas, but he always put in paths that were meandering so that people couldn't see what was up next, which was part of helping your mind relax. He was really visionary in that he used native plants when he put these areas in cities because he wanted people to connect to the larger landscape. And, you know, just kind of having your imagination go from the small to the grand is just an opportunity to kind of get out of that, you know, abraded kind of closed in feeling and relax again in the bigger world. And I sort of think of nature as being kind of, if you can spend time in nature every day, it's almost like a salve. So it's not a quick injection or, you know, we take pills for things, but it's kind of a, you know, a habit that promotes resilience and health. And the evidence for this is really, really strong. And the evidence for kids spending time in nature and that creating lifelong positive benefits is really strong as well. And we can't ignore the history, the science, the personal experiences of so many people and what we all need. We need these natural areas. It's literally our lifelines. The second point about the Redwoods and the awe is, you know, just thinking of times when I've had that feeling and knowing about the research on awe itself. You know, religious experiences in general can promote awe, and so can beautiful music or art. But nature is one of the most powerful experiences to help you to perceive something that's bigger than yourself. And the research on awe showing that it promotes altruism and empathy and compassion and cooperation and all of the things that you would want in yourself and in your community, I just don't even know how you could put a price on that. We so desperately need more of all of those things. So, which is why, you know, you mentioned a big redwood. That's why people just love big old trees. Some people name them, some people talk to them. And in fact, they had a project in one city where they were going to have people send in reports about problems with trees in the city so they could kind of keep on track with it. But what they got in all the emails were love letters about how much they loved that tree. So, I mean, it's something you can experience just with a tree in a city, you know, as much as you can with a redwood.
You've mentioned a few times the research about the various benefits that one can get from being in nature, and especially children. Can you list some of those, please?
So one thing they found in kind of preteens and teens from spending time in a woodland as opposed to a grassland. So they were both kind of time in green space. But specific to the time in the woodland, there was better cognitive function, better emotional regulation, which are especially the emotional regulation is almost like a buffer against the anxiety and, you know, risk for more serious mental illness conditions that happens at the transition from teenage to young adulthood. It's a very, very vulnerable time in any way that we can give children tools in the toolbox, you know, children and teens tools in the toolbox to help their own resilience is really powerful. And in another study, what they found when they looked at zip codes for, they looked at tree cover, which I don't really like as a measure, but they coded all few thousand kindergartners for where they grew up, where they were born, and up until kindergarten. And they found that there were better scores on all kinds of social skills, cognitive skills. I don't have it right in front of me, but there's a battery of tests that were given to the kindergartners, and they were better on all of these measures. And the other thing that I really like is some work out of India, Dr. Pooja Sani, where she looked at time spent in nature as a child and risk of mental illness later and ability to kind of be mindful and engage in mindfulness as an adult, and found that time in nature as a kid promotes lifelong mindfulness. So there's not many, you know, simple, basically free kind of interventions that can have such a powerful lifelong effect, you know, powerful buffer against mental illness and, you know, all of those other benefits. And, you know, one of the things that I want to mention, which isn't mentioned enough, is the benefits for creativity, which has been seen in a number of studies. And we need people to be thinking critically and thinking creatively. So reducing anxiety is great. You know, increasing creativity is just kind of like the next level of benefits that we can have.
So, you know, I'm a writer. I've got, you know, however many books out. And oftentimes when I get stuck writing, I will take a walk through the forest. And I used to think, and okay, I'm going to get woo-woo here, and you don't have to get woo-woo if you don't want, but I used to think that it was my walk through the forest that would settle my mind and let the new ways of looking at whatever it is I'm working on come up or appear. But I've since sort of changed my mind, and I think a lot of times it's that the trees and the plants and the fungi are actually giving me the ideas. And again, you don't have to get all woo-woo on us, but the takeaway point here is, no matter what interpretation you put on it, there is definitely a correlation between me taking a walk through a forest and me solving a particular writing problem I was having. Or I want to take the action away from myself and a writing problem I was working on being solved.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you know, the sort of ability to relax your mind, you know, obviously during sleep, there's some kind of reorganization of your thoughts as well in a, you know, change of state. And I think being in nature, and I think forests are particularly powerful, almost gives you that same sort of type of state change because your visual input is so different. Your auditory input is so different. Your, you know, olfactory input is so different. Everything has really shifted a lot. And I was just thinking about a Swedish pediatric neurologist who I know, Christina Bergqvist, when I told her that I was doing some of this work, and she actually invited me to talk at UPenn and Children's Hospital of Philadelphia on this work. She said, well, you know, we've known this in Sweden forever. If someone is, you know, really driving you crazy and you want to tell them to get lost, and I mean, really like get lost in a pretty emphatic way, you tell them, dra at skogen, which means go to the forest. And the implication is, you know, I don't want to deal with you right now because of whatever, you're being a jerk. But go to the forest and you'll come back and I'm sure things will be better. So I think that's interesting, just not even for like a personal problem that you're solving, but just as a, you know, relationship tool. Just go to the forest for a bit and then come back and we'll figure things out. So
I want to come back in a moment to, you know, small bits of nature in a city that people can find, or as you said, individual trees. But I'm also thinking of a story. This is back in the 90s. I knew someone who was a student teacher or intern or whatever it is that you do at a high school when you're getting a degree in or at an elementary school when you're getting a degree in teaching. And she took some students to a botanical garden, and she said that, and this wasn't even a major city, this is Spokane. And she said that a lot of them were terrified of butterflies because they thought the butterflies would sting them. Mm. And so it's what I'm getting at with this question is there seems to be cities and suburbs create circumstances where a lot of people don't necessarily have the relationships with the anthills and grasshoppers and irrigation ditch and crawdads and cottonwood trees and meadowlarks that I did when I was a kid, or that, you know, whatever area you were from that you had as a kid. And there are a lot of people who are sort of perforce, a lot of children who are perforce in circumstances where they end up thinking that a butterfly can sting them.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I've lived in a lot of different areas, and I think that not having a relationship with those things, often there are little pockets of nature here and there. I mean, nature's kind of everywhere in a way, even like you said, you mentioned little ditches or little pieces here and there. I think we've just gotten out of the habit of having a relationship with it. So it's kind of a negative feedback loop. So I work in Hartford, and there are amazing old forests in Hartford, just amazing, amazing old trees. But I've spoken to people who work, you know, for Parks and Rec, and they said, you know, most of the kids I work with have never even seen a forest. They've just seen maybe trees in parks. But there's definitely beautiful old forests in Hartford, including a beautiful old forest called the 10 Mile Woods, which is the childhood landscape of Frederick Law Olmsted. There's trees there that are over 200 years old. It's magnificent. And, but yeah, some people are afraid. And a native elder that I know that worked at a school in Hartford, right along the river next to an old forest. And she would try and bring the kids down there, you know, pretty young kids, and they would be so scared. And she would just have them sit right here with me. And they would all just sit there. And I think, you know, it's actually, I'm glad you brought this up, because I've just started doing a 6-month training through the Association for Nature and Forest Therapy. And it's a 6-month training to become basically a guide to bring people to the forest. And it's a very specific kind of way that you guide people. And I wanted to do this to be able to offer this primarily to young people who may not have that relationship, may not be comfortable going by themselves, and to just try and help bridge that gap for people.
And how, in your experience, how long does it seem to take between when a young person is like scared of butterflies or scared of everything, and for them to relax in? Is this a 5-minute thing? Is it a 5-day thing? A 5-week thing? How? And I know that's not really a fair question, but do you have any answers?
Well, I could tell you, I haven't gone out with anyone who I felt was truly, truly phobic about it. I've spent most of the time with, you know, probably my students at Trinity College, which are typically, you know, 18 to 22 years old. And I haven't done a specific readout that I could really scientifically say, but I'll tell you, we wore monitors, heart rate variability monitors, one time, and we were walking through the urban area, and we transitioned to this little forested area by the river. And the change in the heart rate variability was really pretty immediate when we went into the forested area. And people were a little bit like kind of nervously chatting when we went in, because it was such a dramatic change from the sidewalk. And now we're in this, it was much cooler. It was so much different in the forest by the river. And then when we came out again, it changed dramatically again. Part of it might have been the temperature, but we did other control experiments later. But it can happen really, really quickly. And one thing that I've really been advocating for is trying to designate these little areas, or whatever size, as sort of a community wild that people will know will be there for them, so they can visit it over and over. Because if you can't go to the same place all the time, you're always kind of overcoming. And sometimes that's good. You want to go to a new area. But if you're someone who's not that comfortable, I think it's good to become very comfortable with an area. And then you can, you know, transfer that skill to going to another area and kind of build on that.
Well, this makes me think of, there's a couple of things. Thank you for saying all that. One of them is that one of them is just the reason I was asking you the question about how long does it take was really because I was hoping you would give the answer you did, which is that the change is almost immediate. That I know that, I mean, there have been so many people that have come to visit here, and you know, we're all just chatting, and this will even be in a car, we're not even walking yet, but we're just chatting. And then when we move from the houses into the redwoods, the conversation ceases in 5 seconds, 10 seconds, you know, mm-hmm. So it was very quick. And so that's one of the things I was hoping you would say. And then the other thing I want to bring up is, years ago, I interviewed Vine Deloria, the American Indian writer, and he said that, he used to teach at University of Colorado, and his students would go take a hike in nature, and they would come back, and then they would say, wow, I had this wonderful nature. Now I have a relationship with nature. And he would always say, well, actually, you had an aesthetic experience, and that's great. But to really have a relationship, it's like with another human being. You have to see it over time. You have to see it change with the seasons. You have to see. And I think about the land where I live, that there's a path that I sometimes do the math on. I don't remember it right now, but I've walked this path probably 30,000 times in the last 25 years, and a couple times a day is all. And it's or four times a day or something. And it's extraordinary to me to, I'll be walking through it, and it's like, I never noticed that particular tree before, or to see the changes through the seasons, et cetera. So I think there is, I think that nature can do something wonderful for us in the short term. And then also having a relationship with a specific place can also bring even more benefits.
I am a very firm believer in that. And most of the studies that have been done are, you know, kind of one-time studies where they looked at changes in heart rate or brain activity or some physiological measure or cognitive measure, et cetera, after an experience in, let's say, a natural area versus an urban setting. There was a study in Ireland that looked at people going to people with mental ill health going to national parks for 13 weeks in a row in a small group. And so they did that for that weekly thing. And they found that the improvements from that going to nature, national parks, was as much or more than if they had seen a therapist once or twice a week during that 13 weeks. But I think if they had gone to the same place, the benefits would have been even more powerful. And that's why I'm actually looking to get some funding to look into this as a way to try and understand the benefits of a long-term relationship with a place that you can count on. And I really think this is an opportunity to talk about our relationship to the land and our relationship to community and ways that all of this can help with our epidemics in mental illness and loneliness. And as I said, help people, like talking about the things that you never noticed before. That happens to me all the time. And you can notice big things and tiny things and across different seasons and weather. And people, I want to advocate for this as a scientist because people are often intimidated by science, but everyone's a scientist at some level. If you cook, if you garden, if you go out, you know, on trails, if you fix things, you know, there's science is everywhere and everyone can participate in it. And we need to encourage people to think like that more. And just because it's beautiful.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Say it again, please.
And just because it's beautiful, you know, just because it doesn't, you don't even need to, I mean, you don't have to notice anything specific or think you're doing science. Just enjoy it. Enjoy the beauty of it for your own, you know, mental health as well. There's no, that's the thing about this kind of experience. It can be whatever it is at that time.
This question's going to seem weird, but we'll come back. Have you ever seen the movie Trip to Bountiful?
Well, this answer is going to seem weird, but it's true. I have what might be considered a black hole in my brain from memories of movies. So I probably not, but I might have. And even if I did, I would probably not remember anything. I also have a black hole in my brain related to jokes. So you could probably tell me the same joke multiple times, you know, give me a little bit of time in between, but it would be funny every time. So
I think we would get along well that way. Because I can't remember if I told it to you. So Trip to Bountiful was a play written in 1954, I think, or early 50s, about this old woman who is unhappy living with her son and his wife, and she keeps trying to escape to get on a bus to Bountiful. And Bountiful was where she grew up and where she was when he was a little boy. And she's very old, and all she wants to do is to get is to see Bountiful one last time. And it's I bring it up because Bountiful is it's not a town. It's just a home, and the way it's shown in the movie is just these fields of Texas bluebells, I guess. And I think a couple of things. One of the reason I bring it up is for two reasons. One of them is that I think is illustrating the powerful pull of how much you can love a place and how important it can be to be in that place. And the other is that, like I said, it was written in the 50s, and they couldn't write that movie now because it would be a trip from downtown Houston to a suburb, and Bountiful would have been destroyed, as opposed to this was like 1819 to 1950. So Bountiful still existed. So that whole point was just the powerful pull. That movie beautifully illustrates the powerful pull of a piece of land.
Yeah, you know what I really, a place that I really love is there's a residential treatment facility in Massachusetts, in Monterey, Massachusetts, called Gould Farm. And it's been around for more than 100 years. Initially, it was sort of like a respite, sort of social program for people who, you know, at that time would have been a grab bag of issues, maybe alcoholism, epilepsy, psychosis, you know, nervous breakdown, who, you know, not really well organized what different people had, but people would go there and work on the farm and try and recover. And it's evolved over time to now being a facility for residential farm for people primarily with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And it's a working farm, and you know, they grow their own food and they make food and they, you know, take care of the grounds and the buildings, and they have a cafe. But they also have these woods and trails that are like this forested kind of sacred areas. And what I think is really beautiful about the model at Gould Farm, in addition to the fact that it gives people meaningful work and a community and good food and all the things that you would need to support brain health and mental health, it also gives them the ability to always feel like that's their place. You know, they're always welcome to go back and visit. And they know if they go there, especially these, you know, kind of sacred natural areas, they know that place will be there for them. And there's surprisingly few areas that people can really count on like that. And I found that out the hard way, as most of the places that I thought were even protected land, it's open to all kinds of clear cutting or various habitat experiments or, you know, all kinds of manipulation. There's not many places that people can just count on. And we really need those kinds of wild places for everything, really. And it's a big gap in our public policies that we're not prioritizing these ecological lifelines that are also kind of critical for helping all of us to move forward in our communities and individually.
So you've said a couple times that the wild nature, being in wild nature, helps with loneliness. And let's pretend that a person walks into a forest by him or herself. How does it help with that person feeling lonely? Or not in the moment, if you want, but also on the larger scale?
Well, you know, I thought of this a bunch of years ago, that I feel like, you know, going there, it's almost like visiting a friend. But then It really is related to, you know, I would say maybe the Native American indigenous idea that these are all, you know, we're all, we're one of many beings. So even if you're there just yourself, you're there with all of those other beings in what some people call the more than human world. And so if you are able to have that perspective, I think you can really sort of settle in and feel like you're there with these other beings. And just like you're saying, you got your, the forest gave you those ideas, all the things in the forest gave you those ideas. The forest is sort of, you know, has all those beings that are there with you and are there for you when you need them. And I know so many people that go out on the land when they're happy. They go out on the land when they're sad. They go out on the land for, you know, to get inspiration. They bring people out on the land. So it's really, it is a real relationship. And loneliness is about wanting to be in relationship.
Thank you for that. And I'm thinking, so I mentioned that this is a redwood forest, and it's also a salmon dependent forest. And sometimes I will say, and it's true, that salmon dependent forests, when the salmon aren't here, they only grow, I'm sorry, when the salmon are here, they grow three times as fast. And then I realize that I'm kind of saying it the wrong way, because that makes it so salmon not being here is the standard. When I say they grow three times as fast when the salmon are there, I should instead say that they grow one third as fast when the salmon are gone, because the default is the standard are gone. And the reason I'm saying all this is that we necessarily, you and I, necessarily keep talking about going into nature. And I think it's important for us to remember that up until through almost all of human evolution, up until very recently, this wasn't being in nature, it was just being, because we evolved actually out there.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm trying to get at? That and I'm not blaming you and I'm not blaming me, but it's just, in terms of long-term human existence, it's weird to say we need to go into nature, although it's necessary now for us to say, do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I have an interesting, I'm glad you brought this up. I have an interesting analogy actually in my laboratory research where I've done, in my lab, I've done work on rats and mice, and there's been revelations during my career that, surprise, if animals, laboratory animals, are in an enriched environment, then they have, you know, better brain structure and branching and all these other positive things. But when you look at what an animal in a laboratory is provided with in a, quote, enriched environment, it's like a tunnel, maybe a block of wood, you know, like a couple little toy type things. And I think we really need a language of a slightly less impoverished environment, because if you compare, you know, that, quote, enriched environment with a couple wood things or plastic things in their cage, it's totally deprived compared to the unbelievable complexity of what they'd be experiencing out in the natural world. So I agree with you. We're getting out of our deprived environment and getting back into where we really should be more comfortable.
I wrote a book about zoos 20 years ago about how horrible zoos are. And I remember one line was about how they were really excited. Some zookeepers were really excited because they gave an orangutan some cardboard and he kept putting it on his head and then putting it on the floor. And it's like, see how excited he is? And what I wrote about that is, can you imagine being so bored that the excitement in your day is putting a piece of cardboard on your head and taking it back off?
Right.
And then another direction I sort of want to go, there's a couple directions. One of them is that I think about a lot about something John Livingston wrote, which was that we are, is that we evolved hearing nature and we evolved in nature and our sensory perceptions were all from a myriad of different beings. And now our sensory perceptions are all created by or mediated by humans. And so, for example, I touch plastic more than I touch human or non-human flesh or tree flesh for that matter. And how John Livingston thought that that meant we were living in an echo chamber. And so we were kind of hallucinating and going crazy and coming to believe that it's easy to believe that non-humans don't matter when you never hear them. And the only thing you ever hear are human voices or commercial jingles. And even I, who've written about this stuff, you know, I can sing more pop tunes and I can identify bird songs and just how, anyway, just that this whole point is about the necessity, not just the importance, but the absolute necessity of being, of hearing non-humans, of hearing and perceive and having sensory perceptions that come from someplace besides a human origin.
Yeah, sensory perceptions and soundscapes of just the natural world. And there's a quote that I gave a talk for my endowed professorship at Trinity. I gave a big lecture for that. And I sort of blended my neuroscience work and my interest in brain health and forests and forest ecology and kind of big picture. And I don't know if you know the work of Bernie Krause, where
I interviewed him.
You did?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's amazing. And his work on soundscapes and how difficult it is now to record natural soundscapes that aren't, you know, polluted basically with human sounds. And just how difficult it is to just be in a natural soundscape. And the quote that I ended my lecture with was of Bernie's, and it was, I think it was, "The music of the divine is growing dim." You know, which just referred to his point that our soundscapes, the natural soundscapes is basically what has evolved through whatever you may believe is a higher power. We're unwittingly degrading and diminishing and losing that.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I mean, obviously, the part of the answer on a big scale answer, I don't know what the question is, but part of the answer on a big scale is to promote wild places, both large and small, and on a more individual scale, it would seem to be to immerse ourselves in those places, big and small. Can you give me any sort of more. Can you, first off, is that, do you agree? And second, can you give more detail on that?
Sure. I mean, what I've been thinking about lately, which relates to this question, I guess, at all levels, is, you know, where do we really go from here? And how do we make decisions about what we're doing, where, and why, so that people can, you know, have the benefits that, and then the essential, you know, essential benefits that connecting to the natural world has, but also writ large, I like the term, you know, life on Earth basically is stabilizing the climate in order for itself to survive. So in epilepsy, we have a term, seizures beget seizures. So if you have a seizure, it's sort of primed that network so that you may be more likely to have another seizure. Well, in terms of, you know, the biosphere and the biomass on Earth and all of the things that are growing and living, they want the climate and the ecology to be supporting themselves. So everything's kind of, the natural world has evolved in order to support itself and therefore support us. So if we really want to figure things out, we need to straight up stop disturbing natural areas that are functioning or are recovering, and, you know, provide a network of these places across all continents and communities. So this involves big areas that are critical, like the Amazon, the boreal forest, these big areas of temperate forest, but it also involves these kind of stepping stones of natural areas that are in communities so that species can move and, you know, migrate and, you know, have different habitat niches to choose from as the temperature and precipitation changes. So it's just so critical that we prioritize these ecological lifelines as a number one thing at all kind of policy levels. And that really is the biggest thing that I'm thinking about right now. How do we make it clear that this isn't against anyone? It's not against any industry. It's not against any kind of anything. This is absolutely for everyone. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, I would just ask you to think about that. Like, how can we survive on this planet without these natural systems that are stabilizing the climate and cleaning the water and doing all that stuff? It's really fundamental and it's not difficult. So that's really kind of the thing that sort of connects everything.
Well, thank you for saying all that. And so two things. One of them is, can you end with just some story you like about being in nature, some cool thing, or cool experience, or cool relationship? And then the other is, can you tell how people can hear more about your work or learn more about your work?
Wow, I'm drawing a blank on a story, actually, which is kind of sad. I don't know.
Newts? Anything to do with newts? Salamanders?
Newts, salamanders. Well,
songbirds.
That's great. I love all mushrooms. Of those things. All of those things. Mushrooms. I'm actually a pretty good mushroom forager. And there have been some big years for certain kinds of mushrooms, giant mushrooms. I don't really have any good specific story. You know, I'm almost like, you know, I feel like when I'm outside, often I'm just so happy to be outside that I'm almost like a happy dog. I'm just happy to be outside. So there's that. And I'm also not great about giving people a way to find out more about me, but I'm easily Googleable. I have a bunch of talks probably you can find. My research is available on Google Scholar or PubMed. And at my profile at Trinity College, you can Google my name at Trinity College. And if you scroll down, I have a few links there to, small things that I've written or other podcasts. And, there's a little description about what I do. And as a final thing, I guess I'll just mention, and this is maybe a story, is how I used to be a regular person on the environment. Really cared about it, loved going out in the woods, but it was really an effort to save a forest on top of the drinking water aquifer in my community that really put things at another level. And that was with a group, Keep the Woods, and it was ultimately successful. But this just opened my eyes to the critical need to really advocate for these places and advocate for how they're protected. And so I really led a double life on doing this environmental work and my neuroscience work at the same time. But I realized that I really need to bring these things together and bring, this is so important. I need to bring all of my skills as a scientist, as a community member, as a mom, as someone who's engaged in public policy discussions and community groups to really, really pull this together and share what I think is the most important thing. So I hope people will look me up and maybe I'll come on again and I'll think of a more interesting story. Maybe that's lost in the same black hole as the joke part of my brain.
No, I think that was a great story. And I would like to thank you for all your work in the world and like to thank you for this conversation and for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Susan A. Massino. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.